Hi everyone and welcome back to Táncház Talk, the world's only English language program focusing primarily on Hungarian folk music. My name is Kálmán Magyar Öcsi, coming to you today from Toronto, Ontario, Canada. Episodes of Táncház Talk, which combine the music of mix and stories delivered by me, are available as always on táncház.com, that's T-A-N-C-H-A-Z.com, or on YouTube. Just search Táncház Talk and subscribe so you don't miss anything. Today we have an episode of Táncház Talk Interviews. This is where I delve into long-form interviews with a wide array of guests. And these episodes of Táncház Talk Interviews are available on all popular podcast platforms, including Apple, Google, and Spotify podcast stores and others. Make sure you subscribe and leave a nice review if you like what you hear. So that's the podcast form of the show, which is always nice because you could download it and listen to it offline at your leisure. Today, I'm very excited to have a discussion with Colleen Birch, Dr. Colleen Birch. And let me tell you a bit about her before we welcome her on. Colleen was born in 1975 in Bismarck, North Dakota. She has a typical North Dakotan heritage. Her father is German and Russian, and her mom has English and Swedish background. Initially, Colleen was a classically trained violinist. She was exposed to folk music through a random freelance gig she had with the Ethnic Dance Theater around 20 years ago. That became her window into Hungarian and then Romanian folk music, and then the rest of the world opened up from there for her. Two decades later, she's a Dr. Colleen Birch. She's a PhD, that's right. She has a PhD from the University of Minnesota in ethnomusicology. Her thesis was, get this, processes of ethnic identification in Transylvanian folk music. I'm so excited to speak with her about that. She's currently a lecturer at Augsburg University's School of Music. One of the classes she teaches there is Worlds of Music. By the way, if you don't know, Augsburg is in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Colleen has received multiple highly prestigious academic grants and scholarships, including the Fulbright Research Award, that's right, the Fulbright, and also United States State Department fellowships and others. She's a member of the Society for Ethnomusicology, and she's published multiple papers. Some of them, here's one, a nice title I like, A Musical Figure of Identity, Embodied Musical Techniques Shared Among Transylvanian Folk Violinists. Another one, Negotiating Identities and Cultural Representations, The Practice and Patronage of Roma Transylvanian Folk Violinist Florin Codoba. That's right, you heard that correctly. That's about Codoba Florin, who has been to North America a couple of times now. Colleen is also a fabulous violinist. She holds two bachelor's degrees, one in music performance and the other in music education. She has a teaching license from the state of Minnesota and is a member of the American String Teachers Association. In the folk music world, she studied at Titi Tábor and Csipke Camp, and of course in Transylvania, including 1 year of training at the Music Academy in Kolozsvár, where she was taught by the great Ovidiu Bartez. And I have written down for myself here to make sure I ask about that, because Ovidiu Bartez is one of my heroes. She has performed for many years now with the aforementioned Ethnic Dance Theater, Orkestar Bez Ime, which is a Balkan group, and of course, Saska, the great Táncház band, together with our good friends Sarah Bruins and Doug Code. That's the Saska band. Colleen has a fantastic YouTube channel. If you search Colleen Fiddle, you'll come up with that. I highly recommend that you check it out and subscribe. She has a lot of great field recordings and will be even playing a clip later on from there. So please help me welcome onto the show Dr. Colleen Birch, calling in from Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hello, Colleen.
Hi, Ochi. Really, that's a really great intro. I need to hire you for like PR and stuff. Wow. I was was like, wow, who is this person? Oh, he's talking about me. Wow.
Yeah, well, if I go with my legal hourly rate, not sure we can come to an agreement on that.
But, yeah, might be out of my range.
Yeah, well, is that weird to hear yourself referred to as a doctor?
Yeah, actually, I guess so. Especially since it's such a new thing. I defended in December, and I was in graduate school for like 10 years, and it took me 2.5, almost 3 years to get to the point of defense for my dissertation because of all these different, you know, barriers that you have to jump over and hoops you have to jump through and that kind of thing. So, yeah, the process was so long that by the time I finally got there, it was like, oh, wow, yeah, it's done. I can't believe it.
It's amazing. Well, I know we spoke with Shalomon a couple of episodes ago, and of course he's going to be defending his. And I know some people take 2 years to do this, some people take 10, and some people never do it. So it's nice that you got it done, and congratulations.
Thank you.
On behalf of the entire Tansaz movement and family. growing up in North Dakota, you know, it sounds like to me you grew up in a episode of Fargo. Oh, geez, Margie, you know, you got the North Dakota, you got the Dakota and the Minnesota. What was it like growing up in that, you know, kind of semi-urban but small city, big village atmosphere?
It's very isolating. Of course, you don't realize that when you're growing up because that's, you know, it's your world as a kid, right? Like, so you don't realize how isolating it is, for the most part. I was lucky in some ways, that, the town that I grew up in, the capital city, Bismarck, they had a really substantial, string program in the school systems, which is how I got, involved in playing violin. It was strictly through the public schools. And, so that was extremely lucky, for me to have that opportunity. On the other hand, it only goes so far. They didn't have like youth symphonies and things like that, to participate in and to get more experiences. So I really had to cobble together these different experiences. And for example, I started teaching violin, when I was like a junior in high school, and, auditioned for the community orchestra, symphony orchestra, the Bismarck Bandan Symphony Orchestra when I was in high school and was able to play in the first violin section of that. So it was a weird combination of like really great opportunities, but only up to like, you know, certain amount or certain level at the same time. My whole family's from North Dakota. Mm-hmm. So like my great grandparents moved there from the Odessa area in the like mid to late 1800s. So I have, you know, a lot of cousins and relatives around there, and a lot of stories about what North Dakota, you know, this plains area with very low population, what it was like, 100 years ago or whatever. And one other musical connection that I have to North Dakota is that my grandfather was an accordionist and he would play barn dances out there. I never got a chance to meet him because he passed away the year before I was born. But, you know, I have photos and collected stories about his playing music for dancers in North Dakota.
What nationality of barn dances? That was just like a straight up American music?
I think he did a lot of polkas and waltzes. Mm-hmm. You know, because this would have been in the like 40s, 50s. Mm-hmm. And I think, and then German, anything German probably.
Right. Mm-hmm. Did you do Suzuki training or just like some kind of other conservatory based system?
It was not Suzuki. It was other. There was one Suzuki program in Bismarck, but I wasn't hooked up into that.
So, when did you move from there into the big city of Minneapolis?
So I went to college in Moorhead. It's Concordia College is kind of well known in this area for being a private Lutheran Norwegian college, and that's where I went and got my my violin performance degree. And after I got that, I went to Minneapolis right afterwards to finish up my music education degree and start networking and playing in different just anything I could get my hands on when I got to the big city.
Right. So you were destined to be, at least in your mind, a musician, teacher, classical idiom, probably.
Right. Yeah. The classical idiom is like really the only thing I knew up to that point.
And then tell me about when you first came across Eastern European, Hungarian, Romanian music. I mentioned in your bio is ethnic dance theater. And so tell us about that and what the ethnic dance theater actually is.
Right. So I'll start with that. The ethnic dance theater is, it's a lot like the Tamburitzens for people who know what that is, except it's not affiliated with a university. It's a community at large group of semi-professional dancers and musicians. And so it's ethnic dance theater kind of, they do a lot of Central and Eastern European performances of music and dance for the theater. They put, concerts together, performances together. They do other things as well, Balkan things and kind of sometimes far-flung performances to the choreographies, but they usually end up doing mostly Central European, Eastern European, and Balkan choreographies. Anyway, so it's a stage performance group, theater group, full with costumes and everything. Mm-hmm. I didn't know about them when I first moved here. I was, I was just like looking for like wedding gigs and church gigs and community orchestras and just recording opportunities and that kind of thing. And I got a phone call. This was back in 2000. I got a phone call from this lady. I didn't know her. She said she knew my old stand partner from Concordia College. Hmm. And she said that he recommended my name. And she was looking for a second violin player to add to the orchestra for ethnic dance theater. And I had to look up what that meant. I didn't know what that meant.
And I
said, yeah, sure. I'm kind of up for trying anything. I wanted to get my name out there and meet people and network. And so I said I would be up for it. So she had the orchestra director give me a call. The orchestra director called, said, hey, are you interested? And I said, yeah, I'll do it. And she said, okay, our first rehearsal is in 2 hours. Can you come over? And I was like, oh, okay, yeah. So I ran up there. And, it was like maybe seven people in the group, a really small group, like accordion, bass, another violin player, guitar, frula, and bidulka. Mm-hmm. And then me adding to it. And they gave me these pieces of paper with like chicken scratches on it, and like, these weird time signatures. I'm staring at these like marks on the page going, what do I do with this? I have no, thinking that I just, graduated with a degree in like performance and I couldn't read this stuff. Mm-hmm. So, and 2 weeks later we had a performance.
Wow.
And it included actually a suite of Dunin Tuli music and dance, and some Southern Romanian, Oltenia, suite, among other things. So that's how I got into it. It was like, getting thrown into the fire and figuring it out.
It's unbelievable how that happens. It's a freelance gig, but it's not an ordinary freelance gig because, you don't have to play a Paco Belcanin and the Aaron G. I mean, someone gives you a 11/8 or 22/8 or, you know, a 7/16 whatever piece of paper, most classical musicians would, you know, would freak out at that. I mean, you see that in Stravinsky and all that kind of thing, but to play for folk dancers, folk music, that must have been quite the shock.
Well, right, and like when you do that, and you know, when you do Stravinsky or something like that in a symphony, you have a conductor that you can at least, you know, find the downbeat and you know, make sure you're on track. But in this group, we didn't have a director like waving his arms around,
right?
It was just like an ensemble, and you just knew the music and you had to play it. And so this is 2000, and believe it or not, they were still passing around cassette tapes for source recordings. So I was handed a cassette tape. Act one was on one side and act two was on the other. And I had never heard this stuff before. I would play it, and I couldn't sometimes like distinguish like the end of a suite of one, you know, region and the beginning of a suite of a different, completely different region. Like I had no concept. I was just really, like really confused. I was like a rat in a maze the first time, like just feeling alongside the wall, not knowing where I'm going. That's kind of what I felt like that first year or two.
Colleen, Ethnic Dance Theater is still active, correct?
Yeah.
It might be one of the only of its kind left. I mean, you know, you talk about the Tamboritsyn, it's a good call. That's you know, it's similar like that, although it's different, and it's for adults as well, not just students. It's also kind of like Aman was in California, in Los Angeles.
Right.
So, you know, there's really, really not much left, or not many of these type of, you know, pan-Europe, East Central European type of groups left. And I think EDT might be one of the only ones at that level. And I'm so happy to hear that even in the Midwest, you know, it's still that's still continuing. There's some kind of funding or some kind of available monies for that to continue.
It's you know, every year is touch and go in terms of funding, but Minnesota is really pretty good about funding the arts in terms, you know, of statewide funding. So there's a couple of annual grants that EDT has been able to plug into. They don't get it every year. You know, when this group has been around for like, I want to say 50 years or almost 50 years or something like that. And so, of course, there's going to be years that get great funding and other years not as much funding. So, the years that they don't have funding, they usually are able to pull together, you know, donations from their longtime fans and subscribers and are able to, you know, get another season. And this is a anomaly, of course, 2020, where they're not really able to put together a concert, a live concert with an audience, but they're looking forward to the spring of next year and hoping that the pandemic will be kind of settled down. And the other interesting thing, you talked about Aman and some of the other groups that used to exist. As they've been folding, they've been either gifting or selling at a very cheap rate their costumes to EDT. So EDT has this huge collection of costumes from all over the world, inherited from these other groups that have been folding.
Beautiful. Before we kind of head into ethnomusicological territory, I have to ask you about a part of your bio, which I didn't read at the beginning, but part of your freelance life. You played with the Moody Blues, is that right? Did I read that correctly?
Well, yeah. I mean, so I've had the chance to play with some of these groups. You know, the setup is that as these groups tour through the United States, they oftentimes will hire local orchestras and or musicians to back them instead of like taking them with like throughout the entire tour, which is really expensive.
Mm-hmm.
So when Moody Blues came through the Midwest, they hired like the Fargo Moorhead Symphony, for example.
Uh-huh.
So it was it wasn't like I was touring with them. It was more just like when they came to town,
Gotcha.
I had the chance of like backing them up.
They have like 7/8 and weird time signatures, don't they?
Oh yeah. So you know, Moody Blues, like, you don't realize how many of their songs, you know, they're one of those kinds of bands, right? Mm-hmm. So like, you're like, oh yeah, they sound familiar. I don't really know if I know any of their stuff. And then you actually start listening to them. You're like, oh, that's the Moody Blues. Oh, that's the Moody Blues. Oh yeah, I know all of these songs. Yeah. And, yeah, and a lot of them are, yeah, they were actually a lot of challenging charts for that particular concert.
I'm sure. Yeah. And I could ask hundreds of questions about just that experience. I know it was short in the blip, you know, and you've had some other ones similar, but I don't want to get bogged down too much into that. I find that very, very interesting. So let's go back to the 2000s. At some point, you make a big decision to go from, you know, classical freelance violinist and teacher track to a teacher in or to a ethnomusicologist. So I know it probably didn't go from 1 minute to the next, but what was the moment, you know, the impetus for that pretty big career shift?
So I would have to say that defining point in time didn't happen until 2008. There was a span of 8 years where I was kind of like learning more about it. Like I said, I was going from like zero, right, and like not knowing anything about it, and then just exploring a little more, going to some do you remember this camp in California called Arancapu?
Arancapu was kind of the successor for a couple of years to Barachag.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and they were only going for like 4 or 5 years or something like that. But I ended up, that was the very first camp I ever went to, and I only went for like 3 days because I didn't know if I would like it, or, you know, I didn't know anything about it. And it happened to have been there last year. And Teiko was their band. Mm-hmm. So, like, what a great band to be introduced to, right,
Who was the violinist then with them?
Vizali Balazs.
Oh, Lord, wow. One of my number ones. Yep.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, he's still like one of my favorite all-time Tansaz musicians. Like, his technique is incredible. So that was, you know, those three guys, Havashredi, Paul, and Yuri. What's Yuri's last name?
Lani Yuri.
Lani. Yeah. So yeah, those three guys were like just so fantastic. Mm-hmm. And to be introduced to that, and I just, again, like, that was my first Tansaz experience, was sitting in those evenings and listening to those three guys play, and you know, my eyes were going crossed. I couldn't believe what was happening, and really, you know, and Balazs was like, you know, you should play with us, like, just sit behind and play along. And I'm like, there is zero possibility of that happening. I have no idea what you're doing. But it was really great, and they turned out to be really good friends who, like, introduced me to a lot of things when I went to Hungary for the first couple of times. So so a lot of little things happened in those first eight years that kind of slowly like built my interest and my understanding of what was happening. But the real impetus happened in 2008, when I finally got to get to Transylvania and travel around and meet a lot of village musicians on my own. And I was there for maybe a month or 2 months, something like that. Just, it was self-funded. Self-directed. Hruz Danish of Duvo helped out a lot in terms of getting me set up at like Heltoy in Kolozsvár. If you know this place, it's a student, it's kind of a Hungarian student youth hostel / places to take classes, like language classes and stuff.
Okay.
So he set me up there, and so I think, if I remember correctly, I ended up visiting like 16 different groups of musicians in 16 different villages on that very first trip. And It was when I got back from that that I really started seriously considering going to graduate school for ethnomusicology. Just that experience alone was amazing.
Wow. So who took you around? I mean, you visiting 16 groups of musicians and villages, in the course of a month or two. Who's your tour guide there?
So I had, there were a couple of different situations. Hruzdanish picked me up, and then also a couple days later, Sarah and Doug from Saska flew in, and we all drove together from Budapest into, actually our first stop was Sake, I think. Mm-hmm. And so he took us to a couple of different spots. He took us to Gerla, and it was the first time I ever heard Hevader. Hevader played at some festival there, and mm-hmm. And then he, Hruzdanish took us to Ture to stay with Ture Latsi.
Ture Latsi, yeah.
And his mom, Ilka Nini.
Mm-hmm.
So he dropped us off there, and it was Ture Latsi who really set up all kinds of meetings for us, and he took us to some out of the way places, probably for some towns has people like Valle Larga, for example.
Hmm.
Budest to see Nuku, and who else? And then of course like some Klotasegi guys, and that's when I met Changor. Laszlo.
So you mentioned Doug and Sarah from Saska. At that point, have you already been playing with Saska?
Oh, right. Yeah, so that was another big thing that happened in that first 8 years, like just learning about Tanzas and learning about music from Transylvania. I had met Doug and Sarah. They were in Madison, Wisconsin, and a mutual friend that I met at one of those camps said, hey, you should get together with Doug and Sarah and start a band. You guys live in the same area, meaning like the distance between Madison and Minneapolis is like, you know, it's like a 5-hour drive.
Yeah.
So she was like, you should start a band. You all live in the same area. So I met Doug and Sarah. They hadn't really met me, maybe in passing at some festival, but Doug invited me to come and stay at their house and for a weekend and just play music. And so I took them up on that, went out there and we hit it off, and we've been a band ever since. They had already played with Ninka Ooms.
Yes.
Before that for quite a while. And then she and her family picked up and moved for work opportunities overseas. So they didn't have a violin player for a long time. And then when I came into the picture, then we kept going. That was in 2006 when I started with Saska.
I remember the resurgence of Saska back then. And I didn't really know you personally, I think. But I remember there's a new violinist on the scene. And that was great to hear. And I remember Nienke, she had to leave. She left back to Holland or something. I don't know where they went.
Yeah, they went. They went somewhere crazy, like not crazy, like Armenia or something, or like they went somewhere pretty far east for her job, I think.
So, but
she's in Holland now.
Right. Okay. She's back. So ethnomusicology. What is this? That study. What is that discipline all about? What does it mean?
Well, you know, it means something slightly different in America than it does in Europe, just slightly. In America, it's really kind of it's kind of a marriage between anthropology and music, maybe like the study of human behavior through the lens of music, something like this. It's a loose definition. So that's kind of how we approach it, more kind of a combination between anthropology, cultural anthropology, and music. And in Europe, maybe it depends on the school, but they grew out of what's called comparative musicology. And so they grew out of a practice of more like categorizations, you know, like collecting melodies as like these objects, mm-hmm. and analyzing those musical objects and then putting them into categories. That was a really big practice, especially like with Bartok's, you know, his entire project that he spent his life on, and Kodály. And so that's, I don't mean to reduce it to that. It's not, it's more than that, of course, but that's kind of where it grew out of. So we have okay. slightly different, approaches or goals in our ethnomusicological studies, I think.
So, they still, though, look at the, in Europe, they must look at the anthropological aspect, the people and the reasons why.
I think so. Yeah. But they, from what I've seen or read, the type of things that I've read about it, they usually, use as their proof, like analysis of music, like a melody, for example, or maybe it's a chord progression. I don't know, but like taking like the structure of a Hungarian melody. Right. And like, looking at that and using the categorization of how they categorize that as part of their proof for what they're talking about, mm-hmm. in terms, you know, and we don't necessarily do that so much. You know, we don't necessarily look at musical objects and try to dissect it and then try to say that this is proof of how somebody's identity works or how they present something. I'm being super detailed, I guess, about how I'm splitting hairs here.
No, that's important. It's really important, I think, and interesting. I'm going to, you know, Hungarians, we like to take credit for everything. So let me make a statement. And let's see how you react. And what I've okay. read and heard is that Béla Bartók is, or might be, the first original ethnomusicologist. Back to you, Dr. Birch. What do you think?
He's probably one of the first big names that really was very quite prolific. He wasn't the first, though. If you take a look at his own history and how he decided to come up with his categories. He based his premises on other people that had come before him. Of course, I'm not going to be able to come up with those names right off the top of my head, but he did, you know, coming up with a categorical system the way he did, he didn't just one day sit down and just make this stuff up. He mm-hmm. was looking at what other people were already doing and modifying that, taking what he thought would work and those kinds of things. But I think it's safe to say that he's the first big name, kind of internationally known name, right. Of being an ethnomusicologist. Yeah.
Okay.
As some people would say comparative musicology as opposed to ethnomusicologist, but again, I'm splitting hairs.
No, I get it. Well, that's your job. Okay, as they say in the law, it's not like you're right, you're just not wrong when I say that, so that's good, in terms of Béla Bartók. Now, you know, and
right.
he took this stuff that he collected and he, you know, made an international name for himself as a composer and as a pianist and a musician and you know, the guy was really unbelievable.
Yes.
In terms of that, and you know, when you're getting your degrees and studying ethnomusicology, or even just, you know, musicology in general, your professors are probably not really talking about East Europe, Central Europe, specifically. What area of the world is usually most discussed? Do they talk about Indian music or African music, or what do you mostly kind of hear about in school?
How do I explain this? It depends on the school. It depends on the professor at the school because of whatever their particular expertise is. And the goal for us in America is not to try to say that, like, you're an expert in, or that you're specifically studying music from X country or X region. That's not how we go about it. We go about it from theoretical standpoints. We're looking at methods. We're looking at ethnomusicology as a science that can be applied to any culture or musics that we choose to look into.
Mm-hmm.
So that being said, there are trends here for sure. And especially when you're out job hunting, they'll specify, like, we're looking for an ethnomusicologist who has an expertise in X, you know. So African musics in general is a super hot area, partly because it's been grossly underrepresented mm-hmm. for so long that they're trying to right that wrong. India is also a very big area, has been for a while, and Indonesian gamelan.
Mm-hmm.
These things have been really, really huge, but it's there's two different strands of American ethnomusicology too. There's two different schools of thought. One came out of Mantle Hood's program at UCLA, where he was more interested in, like, setting up these experiences of different world musics, and that's kind of participant observation kind of experiences. So out there, they have all these different world music ensembles that you can join into and learn about, you know, ethnomusicology through participation of right. these things.
Mm-hmm.
Alan Merriam was at Champaign-Urbana in Illinois,
mm-hmm.
and he's the one that came up with a stronger, like, anthropological tie to ethnomusicology and to really kind of, I think he actually placed the ethnomusicology department in the anthropology department.
Huh.
So that was way more like theoretical, and about methods. How do you go about studying people and cultures, even though you're going to come at it from a musical background and you need to have a musical background in order to get into that program, right? So it's, there's kind of like competing approaches, but neither one of them, I mean, they both tout the idea of being able to use your studies to study whichever music genre or practice that you find interesting or that you want to study. So
yeah. Okay, so that's Mantle Hood at UCLA, and then Alan Merriam at Champaign-Urbana. Those are the two type of, you know, strands, so to speak, two different approaches, maybe. And when you mentioned, you know, methods, different methods, I mean, there must be methods of how to collect, where to collect music, you know, how to you know, get at it physically, right? And then the categorization of it as well. And then kind of what to do with it next, right? Like, I'm just guessing. This is your field. So maybe you could just give us an overview of the methods that we're talking about, because this will, I think, lead in really nicely to the work that you've done in Transylvania in the last 5 years or so.
So, I mean, just very, very broadly, the type of methods that we use are, like, number one, just, like, straight-up interviews, right? Number two, a prolonged stay in a specific area so that you're not only relying on what people are saying, but you're kind of observing what they do and how things function in a certain society. So those can be considered kind of like the anthropological, you know, influences. And then you have the emic and the etic positions of participation, right? So like the insider and outsider positions of musicality, of being a musician in that location. So you can either like sit and watch performers and just analyze, diagram how things are set up, record the different musicians and try to analyze how they're working together, that kind of thing. Or you can actually participate in the music making and experience it. And the approach to that is, and the thought behind that is that your bodies can have a certain amount of knowledge as well that you might not be able to read about or categorize or, but when you learn how to do something, your body is learning something. Your body is knowing something that is more difficult to put into words.
These interviews are interesting in terms of when you're saying you observe and then you also could, you know, interview your subjects. I mean, when you're talking to somebody that's been doing this all their lives very innately, like Cordoba Florin, like, you know, Kishchipash or Chongor or whoever else, you know, I'm wondering whether they can actually even tell you what they're doing, how they're doing it, and why. Or they must be surprised when you make an observation about something they're doing, you tell them what they're doing, and they said, oh, I didn't even know that. Like, I have no idea about that. I'm sure you've had those experiences, but maybe you could talk a bit about that. You know, how do you interview somebody that's like, say, it's like asking somebody, how do you walk, you know, the right foot and then the left foot? Like, what's that all about? Well, that just happens. Like, it's so innate, it's so natural.
Yeah, that happens kind of regularly, where it's like, this actually ties into my dissertation, right? Where like, there's this ornament that, there's so many different layers to this, but there's this ornament, and I'm calling it an ornament, that Ovidio Bartes called a groupette. And it's you've heard it. I know a lot of you and your listeners have heard this ornament. It's that turn.
I'm going to take out my, I have my fiddle here, actually. I'm going to take it out of my case so we could demonstrate, yeah. I think. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's the three-note turn, right? So it's not the like, shaky two-note vibrato thing. It's not that. It's the turn that's, like, super, super fast, right?
Right.
Do you have your violin?
I do. Right?
Yeah. Yep, it's that thing, right?
Okay.
And so I was taking this class from Ovidio Bartes, and in this class, we had to transcribe these melodies, and then he would also give us his transcriptions, and we would have to play them, like just sight read them, just as practice. And I found it interesting that he never wrote, his transcriptions are amazing. They're so detailed, but he never wrote out that particular ornament ever. Hmm. It was not marked anywhere. And I pointed it out, and at first he didn't know what I was talking about. And then he thought it through, and he was like, oh yeah, I guess that's just something that we do in Transylvania. Mm-hmm. And, it was like months later when I asked him about it again, like on a text message, and he wrote back to me. He said, yeah, I guess I would call it like use the French term groupette, because it's this super fast turn as many times around as you possibly can in whatever, you know, musical impulse. So even this guy who's like, you know, he's working on his doctorate as well, like super knowledgeable. He lives there. He breathes this stuff. He's an expert in this stuff. He didn't even realize that that was something that he was doing that might need some kind of a label, or could be helpful to have a label for it anyway. Mm-hmm. Because all these guys were doing it. So same thing with, and Florine does it, you know, yeah. All these Transylvanian fiddle players do this ornament, and Florine does it. He was doing it, we were at Chipa, and I was asking him about this, and I even had a difficult time getting him to understand what I meant about ornaments. Like, he didn't understand what I meant by an ornament at all. and he kept playing things like a cifra. Like, I would say, no, this ornament, and I would try to play it, and he would say, like, floricelle, you know, like, floweriness, and I'm like, yeah, floweriness, and then he would go, okay, well, here, and then he would play a cifra, and so, like, we just had this really weird, like, miscommunication, and I think, and this is a hang-up that you can have with interviews, mm-hmm. like, cross-cultural interviews,
mm-hmm.
But then also if you're developing a relationship over a long period of time with these people, it's a longer conversation. So he was at Chipka like in 2014,
mm-hmm.
2013.
Sounds about right. Yeah, somewhere around there.
And then when I visited him again, when I was there in Transylvania, he had thought it through, and he started to understand what it was I was talking about, but it took a couple of years in between, and we were starting to chip away at this. Turns out that I was really forcing him to explain something that I thought was so obvious in, you know, from how I grew up playing violin, that just didn't make sense to him necessarily, right? Like,
yeah.
Because he didn't approach the violin that way. He doesn't approach the melodies that way.
Right.
It's, you know, he doesn't play this note and then add something to it or mm-hmm. hang something on it, on mm-hmm. that note. And the other thing that was really interesting about this conversation with him is he kept diverting the conversation about ornaments to the bow arm. And that blew my mind. I was like, I didn't understand what he was doing. But he was taking it as a conversation about style and energy, right? And so he kept talking about the bow arm. He was like, you know, the left hand isn't so important. It's the bow arm. And you know, he's like, if you can get the bow arm right, then and you think the melody how you want it to sound, then the left hand's just going to come. That's how he thinks of it.
Right. Oh, it's so interesting. You know, it's when you're talking about something so innate and so natural, it's almost nice to have, you know, him sitting there and then someone like you who can kind of be the go-between to tell the rest of the students what's going on, you know, and because you're at this point, obviously, let's say with Florin, because you spent a lot of time there and observing him, you know, you would probably know the story or know what's going on. But I think, you know, I remember Judy Olson. Do you know Judy Olson?
Yeah.
Yeah, she would videotape for years our Tanzhases, and then she said, you know, when the guy during the Legianesh, you know, lifts his leg up and you really do a nice accent on the violin, and you almost jump out of your chair, Richie. I don't, you know, what is your rationale for doing that or something like that, and like, you know, it's a very odd question, and it makes me think now. Ever since she mentioned that I do that, now I almost do it like more purposefully. And I think about her when that happens, where she would ask about when do the women do the calls, you know, the chuyogotash. When does that happen? Why? It was a coordinated effort. Is it you know, is it peer pressure? Is it, you know, social group structure? Whatever it is, it's just right. I think it's wonderful. It's, you know, and maybe some people listening in on this conversation, some of them say, like, we just sit down, we play music, we dance, we have a great time, and then we look forward to the next Saturday night, we can do it all over again. There's that. And then there's, like, people who kind of really digging into it. And then there's people like you, I think, who are kind of on the both sides, because you're a scientist, and you're also a musician, a practicing playing musician in this area. You play Tanzhases with Sasko all the time.
Right.
Yeah. So that gives you a very interesting added advantage on both levels.
I have to be very careful too about, like, just leaving one hat behind when I'm doing the other thing, right? Like, I have to almost have a split personality sometimes.
Right. But do you think, you know, not growing up with this music gives you the ability to see things that maybe someone like me who did grow up with this music just simply can't, or it would be difficult to do that?
It's possible, but you know, I also have to be really careful to not interject something that isn't there, right? So it's both. You know, I think outsiders always have can potentially bring in something new and some new perspectives, but you also need to know when, like, oh, you might be bringing in something there that doesn't really belong there, or, you know, so you always have to be aware of that as well.
Yeah. Well, I want to read something from your bio on the Augsburg University website, which talks about the following. It says, Colleen's current ethnographic work investigates various stylistic approaches to the violin, e.g., the melodic ornament called the Transylvanian groupette, there we go, bowing patterns, and coordinated left and right hand musical gestures that are commonly heard as being specifically Transylvanian. Commonly heard as being specifically Transylvanian is interesting. Maybe you can talk about what that means. And you might not be suggesting, of course, that something in Sék will sound the same as something in, you know, in Vojdaszent Iván. But maybe you can talk about what that means in terms of commonly heard.
Right, exactly. So I'm not talking about, like, oh, the repertoire is the same, or even necessarily larger stylistic approaches, but there are certain things. I'm kind of coming at it from the opposite direction, where there are certain stylistic things that are kind of pan-Transylvanian. I don't mean to say that it's like every folk musician in Transylvania, like, uses these, you know, stylistic things that I'm talking about here. But when you do hear it, it's common to Transylvania and not to, like, southern Romania, for example, or Moldova, or, mm-hmm. you know, this kind of thing. So, and one of those stylistic traits, like you mentioned, and what we were just talking about with the Transylvanian groupette, right? And I was talking to Bartej about this, and we kind of feel like the way it's articulated in Transylvania is specific to Transylvania. Not that you don't, I mean, you definitely hear a three-note turn in all kinds of music, including classical music, right? But the way it's articulated in Transylvania, the way it's used, is very Transylvanian specific. Like, even if you compare, let's say, how Ovidiu Bartej plays, which I think of it as kind of a classical approach to folk music. He has that kind of dual stylistic mm-hmm. Training. If you compare how he plays Transylvanian folk song compared to, like, how Bogros in Chișinău, how he might play a Transylvanian tune, you can hear the stylistic differences. And I think part of it's that groupette, part of it's the bow energy. And then this other thing that I'm trying to get at, I don't quite have the words for it yet, but there is something about the combination between the two hands and how they work together, that there's something there. In classical music, we're trained to, like, do finger before bow. Did you guys ever, I mean, I'm sure you talked about this, or you had exercises
yeah.
like this.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Where you, like, you specifically train your body to play your finger down, then bow, finger, mm-hmm. bow, in order to create this super clean, like, non-residual noise kind of a thing. And I think in Transylvania, there's something else going on where it's also the goal to play very cleanly. You know, the best players still are very clean players, but there's a connection between the two hands that are not regimented one note at a time kind of a thing. It's more like a gesture.
Yeah. I get it. I understand. Good luck talking about it or writing about it.
I know, right. Right. That's the game.
Right.
That's the whole game.
That's the game. Yeah, that's the game, and that's your game. Like, you know, guys like Floating, they're not going to do it for you, right? So you, that's,
right.
And I think we need that. I often, when I teach, I talk about the right hand. You know, in classical music, it's kind of the great consistency, the great, you know, that's kind of supposed to stay equal out, like you're saying, the focus is all oftentimes on the left hand, but in our folk music, there's the missing, untalked about, not talked about, or oftentimes ignored factor is the right hand, the bow hand.
Yes.
So that's interesting. Now we're getting really micro. I want to kind of, well, before I leave that, I want to ask you about Ovidiu Bartej. Now he's a great violinist. Can you, where is he from? Just really briefly, because I actually don't know. What's his background and training?
I can only tell you a few things about him. And I think I'm correct in saying this. He's from Bystrica. That's where he was born and raised. And he, I don't know when he started studying classically, but I know that he played when he was young. He played with, different Roma musicians in the area for like weddings and that kind of thing when he was little.
Okay.
So he kind of straddles both worlds.
Okay.
He's had experience both. Like I said, I don't know when he actually started going to conservatory, but he did at some point and did very well for himself. And then during communist times, was running different ensembles and I'm not sure when he's also right now the director of it's called Cununa Transylvania, the like wonderful Transylvanian orchestra, like, okay. So it's Kolozsvár's like state funded folkloric ensemble.
Okay.
That's, you know, kind of an orchestra, like an orchestra, but it's a smaller ensemble than that.
Okay.
So he's the director of that as well. They're representing kind of the higher art form of Transylvanian folk music.
Gotcha.
It's not politically correct for me to say it that way, but the art high, you know, the classical art form.
Right. Well, with the musica popolare, I think they're like the popular. That's like the folk music with.
It's a little different from that.
Okay.
But along those lines, yeah.
So just so if anyone's confused listening here, Transylvania is the. Used to be sore subject before World War I, the eastern part of Hungary, a very large area, and but now it's the western part of Romania. It was annexed to Romania after World War I, and so there are many, almost 2 million Hungarians living there, or lived there. Now I think it's a bit less than that, but and of course we have the Romanians and the Roma people and some old Saxons still living in that area. So. Very vibrant place, and that's where Colleen's field work and ethnomusicological work has been focused on. So let's talk about that. You 2008 was the first trip, and wow, you were wowed then. And then you made a decision at some point, I guess, to really focus on this area, and then travel back to Transylvania. You were there for, I know, a whole year. So let's talk about that. And where did you study as well? Because I think I may have missed that.
Okay, so as a graduate student at the University of Minnesota, I applied for and received a Fulbright award to be in Transylvania for a year, and that was specifically to conduct my dissertation field work. So I got to Cluj, to Kolozsvár, and... I really had to make my own way. The Fulbright Commission didn't really hold my hand, or like I really had nothing to answer to.
Yeah.
Which was actually a really great situation for me. I did have a very slight affiliation with two ethnomusicologists at the Gergadima Music Academy, the Hoplias, as a husband and wife team. Doina and Jon Hoplia.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very helpful in terms of like helping me with logistics, like legal logistics and getting paperwork and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I took some classes from Dr. Jon Hoplia that were all in Romanian, so higher level classes that I was trying to decipher with my intermediate Romanian skills, which was a great learning experience. But So I was doing that, and then I also was allowed to sit in on all the, he was calling it a Transylvanian folklore violin class, and this was Ovidiu Bartiș's class that he teaches there at the same academy, the Music Academy.
Wow.
And so one class per semester, mm-hmm. and it was really just like immersive, getting the lay of the land of the different musicians and the history and of the folk violin.
And that's in Romanian, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. It was all in Romanian.
Okay.
The class was small. It was like maybe five or six of us total. Uh-huh. And by that point, I could understand most of what was going on. And then if I had any questions, then some of the other students would like write me little notes or something to help me, you know. I would say the most confusing thing for me was translating like musical solfège.
Yeah.
And, you know, because of the fixed system versus the movable system.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you would say like C for sol, or is that right?
Yeah.
C for sol. And, but I thought he was saying the letter C, and like, so like, it was like, that right. was a constant nightmare for me trying to figure out, you know, which he was saying.
Right.
But anyway, so I did those things at the Music Academy, and then, parallel to that, I was also going to rehearsals with Marti Șorul Ensemble, which is a kind of a Romanian folkloric ensemble that was set up at the Casa de Cultura. And that was also a great experience because I got to tour around the country with them and do performances at different festivals and stuff.
You were in their band?
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, in their orchestra. Yeah.
What year? Yeah. What year were you there? What years?
Fall of 2015 through the summer of 2016.
Okay.
Well, it was like summer to summer, basically.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So, a lot of your work was going to the, you know, to the countryside, so to speak, to the various villages. Which villages did you go to? The most, and which musicians did you research the most?
So most of my research ended up just circling around the Meșteșug area. The Câmpia in Romanian is the term that they use. So there were two main musicians that I spent a lot of time with, and one was Florin Codoba, he was, when I first got there, he was living in his old apartment that he got from his dad, you know, that he lived in with his dad. He was still living there back, I don't know how well people know the city of Kolozsvár, but there's a really popular Hungarian restaurant bar called the Volga Cove. Mm-hmm. And he lived right behind that. And when I first got there, that's where he and his family were. And then they, a couple months in, he moved out to a suburb of Kolozsvár. So he would travel in and out between his new house and Kolozsvár to give me lessons. And so I took regular lessons from him then. And then we would go out together to Paletka and, mm-hmm. and meet up with the guys out there. So that was kind of an ongoing thing that just kind of kept happening throughout the year. And then there was another guy, a Roma guy from Mochu. I think in Hungarian, the village is Moch. Does that sound right to you?
M-O-C-H?
I think so, or M-O-C-S in okay. Hungarian.
Okay. Oh, M-O-C-S. Right? Sorry. Let me just look. But keep going. Okay.
Okay. So there's another guy. And this is not far from Paletka. And the music is similar, not identical. But I would spend a lot of time with this guy as well. His name's Carl Suli. And he ended up being more of a guide for me. And he would set up meetings with all these other musicians in the Meza-Sheikh area, mm-hmm. for me to go and record and talk to. So he kind of became my kind of guide slash stepfather, you know, slash, I don't know, you know, he was very helpful.
So that is Mocs, M-O-C-S, with a long O in Hungarian, yes.
Yeah.
And Mezőkeszű technically belongs to that kind of commune or that kind of area as well.
Okay, yeah, so he took me to, like, Suatu. I'm trying to think of, like, the Hungarian names, like Magyar Szovát, for example. Like, these areas kind of... A little farther south from Palatka, right? Mm-hmm. But kind of that little area down there. He took me through and introduced me to a lot of guys. And I met Alexandru Cercui.
Okay.
Is
that the violinist that was...
That lived in New Jersey or...
Or Washington, D.C.?
Maybe it was Washington.
Yeah, from Sopot, Mezőszopot.
Yep, exactly. So he's back there in the village again. He was here for like 12 years or something.
Yeah.
And had just recently moved back to the village.
Mm-hmm.
So.
That's great. So, Colleen, you're going, like, this is kind of awkward, right? I mean, you're going with your microphone and you're, you know, it's maybe you don't catch them on a wedding or playing a wedding or playing a ball or playing a festival or something. You know, you're pretty much going to these people's homes and I mean, how do you get them to perform? I'm always curious. You know, we have these great recordings, but we don't know much about the story behind it, how it happened, how it got set up. You know, is there alcohol? Is there money? Is there, you know, what's involved? Without, of course, and you're trying to do this, you know, using the proper ethnomusicological methods, which you could later defend at a dissertation. Defense. So, you know, how does it generally go if there's a general way of these things happen?
I don't know if there really is a general way of these things happening. Like, you know, my guiding star is like always remain flexible. You know, you just have to like constantly go with the flow because nothing's ever going to turn off the way you're imagining it to go, right? So, when I was going with this guide from Mocs, he would set it up in a way beforehand where it was more like I was going to pay them a little bit of something in order to record and to have a conversation with them. So that's kind of how that entire system was working with him and with his guideship. And it worked out just fine. In a way, it was... It was what it was because like it was pretty well defined a set amount of time, you know, usually in these situations where it was like I was going and we were going to be there for 45 minutes or 1 hour, and this is, you know, so that's just how it was. I appreciated that I got to get the lay of the land and what musicians were still working, who, you know, who was still out there, what their level was, you know, at that particular time, you know, were they still active, were they not still active, what does the area look like, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't get a huge, a really great sense then of the actual performance atmosphere, you know, which can really help a lot and tell you a lot. And so there were other situations where I was able to see that. And those kinds of situations oftentimes would happen by surprise. You know, you just happen to be invited at the last second to go to some, you know, party or something. And, you know, you check your purse and make sure you have some kind of recording device in there, you know, to make sure you have something to record it with. Back in 2008, I felt like it was more, there were more situations where it was like hang out and have a party, you know, with, you know, wine and some slanina and hang out all night kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
but even some of those situations were a little bit more set up. It was like, hey, we're gonna have a party so that we can play music and we can talk about this thing, and
right,
you know.
So, like, so what are they signing? Like, this all this the money that's going on to this, I mean, it's probably not a king's ransom amount, but you know, still you're like, no one's signing invoices, and you know like you're like, this is all funded by your grants and your awards and all that. It's a part of the budget, so to speak, performance budget.
Yeah, I mean, I was taking you know, kind of my living expenses that the Fulbright Commission gave me to try to fund all of this. And like you said, it was you know, not huge sums, you know, but I definitely had to budget how often I could go and how much I could pay. That's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I grabbed a clip off your website on the YouTube, and this is let's play a little of this. This is traditional string music from Tude, from Kalotaseg, and there are three musicians on this. Laszlo Csongor, Tony Rudi, and Junior, and Laszlo Lehel playing the accordion. And then I'm going to ask you, you know, as an example, how this recording came about, what's the backstory of it, and then I would like to ask you, what happens with it? What happens once you record it, okay? So, like, you know, but we'll talk more about that. Let me just try to play this here. Sorry, I'm just going to play the audio. I'm looking at the video, and people can also check it out. It's there's two there's a bunch of, like, some alcohol on the table, some food I see, a nice little, you know, they're sitting at like a kitchen or a living room area, and these three guys just kind of, you know, just kind of playing a performance here for you. And Laszlo Csongor is wearing a hat, Tony Rodi's in the middle playing his mean braccio, and you know, so looks like the weather kind of is crappy outside. So anyway, what's the story? How did this recording come about? And in Tude.
So that particular video is, it's actually in Tude, and that was at Tude, Lati Tude's mom's house, where Doug and Sarah and I were staying when we first got there. I think the situation was, Lotzi was already working on trying to, like, put together these little trips for us to collect music and to meet musicians. And these guys were, you know, from the area. And I think what was happening that year was that they were trying to push a new band, and I'm trying to think of what they were calling themselves.
Churros Bundle.
Churros, yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
And I think they kind of had just kind of started, or at least recently, maybe within the last year or two, of that. And so I think they were, I think it was kind of almost like a promotional kind of a thing, right? Like,
okay,
and
yeah.
So therefore, like, the dress up and the, you know, and creating a party and hanging out and that kind of thing. And also, I think Lotzi was really working towards establishing Tude as a place of musical history as well.
Mm-hmm.
So we never, I don't think we ever actually even went to Mera, for example. Like, he was really trying to establish Tude as a musical place.
That's why he's called Tude Lotzi.
That's why he's called Tude Lotzi. That's right.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the quick explanation of what was going on there. And I'm going to tell you the longer explanation of kind of the situation of what happened. That was a surprise. Before I had ever made it to Transylvania, I had been taking trips to Budapest to try to, like, just, like, find Tons has experiences, you know, going to Fono and this kind of thing. And I finally made it to the Tanzas Talalcozo. This is probably like 2006 or something like that. And I didn't know anybody. Like, I didn't know any Hungarians. I didn't know, like, I was completely, like, alone on my own. Mm-hmm. So going to this huge sports arena for this huge festival in the middle of Budapest, or out in the outskirts of Budapest, and not knowing anybody, just spending time, like, going around and checking things out. And it gets a little bit late, and I'm thinking, okay, the last train is at 11, and I knew this, so I go out there at, like, 10:30, 10:45, something, to catch the train back home to the center. And they had, like, I walked onto the platform, and they announced that trains have stopped for the evening. So I was like, oh, okay, great. So I'm going to try to figure out the buses. So I go out, and I figure out a bus, and I get on the bus, and it goes one stop, and the driver gets up and says, that's it. This is the last stop. Everybody has to get off. So I'm stuck out a block away from this the sports arena, and I have really no idea where I'm at, and it's dark. And I start walking back towards the sports arena, and a homeless guy, you know, who I, you know, wasn't completely all there, started following me and started heckling me, and I sincerely got very scared. I was out in the middle of, like, a huge, huge parking lot, and no lights around and nothing around, so I got very scared, and I walked really quickly back to the sports arena, and I saw this really familiar scene in the parking lot. It was a band van, right, like a big white van, and these guys were loading music gear into the back, and I was like, okay, I understand that situation. I'm heading over there, right? So I run over there, and I'm really shooken up, and the driver's asking what's going on, and then the musicians, they pop out, and they surround the homeless guy and kind of chide him, you know, kind of lightening up the situation and getting him away from me, and I'm crying my head off. I'm so scared. And this guy is saying, okay, I'm going to help you figure out, like, a bus. I'm going to help you figure this out. And then finally he just says, just get in the van. I'm going to drive you home. Wow. So this van driver was very sweet and took me home. It turns out to be Lotsy. I didn't know him. And the band was the Churosh band. And so
wow,
it was very strange for 2 years later to have, you know, this trip figured out, and Hru's Danish helped us set this up, and we get to this house in the middle of Ture and walk in, and here's the guy who saved me in Budapest.
Oh, wow.
And it's his mom's house, and the musicians that were also there who also helped with the situation. So
Colleen, that's unbelievable. I've never heard that story. That's great. What a fortuitous small world meeting, you know. I actually wanted to ask you, you know, this is a, for better or for worse, it's a very male-dominated type of environment, the folk musicianship. And so, you know, what advantage or disadvantage does it give you that you're a woman doing this research and spending lots of times with these guys, often testosterone-infused situations, I can imagine, you know, alcohol and women and all that, you know, what is that like? Sounds like they're protecting you by and large, but tell me a bit about that.
There is an advantage in terms of, you know, people looking out for you, you know, and wanting to help and protect you on the one hand. The great disadvantage is that it needs to be on their determination, right? So you can only, you know, lean on people's good good will when they have the time to do it, and you know, if they're busy, they're busy. I had it was really tricky actually finding, how do I say this? It was really tricky going out on my own and establishing my own connections with musicians I had not met before, because of being a woman and how that's read over there. And I'll, just like one example, this, guide of mine for Moch, Carl Tsuli. Mm-hmm. I met him, while I was with another person who was a male. So there was that kind of buffer there. So that introduction was fine. Mm-hmm. I wasn't alone. After that point, I would drive up there by myself and pick up Carl, and he would guide me to the different villages. And a couple weeks into doing this, he and his wife sat me down and said, "We don't think you should be driving alone through mm-hmm. Transylvania." And I said, "Oh, I'm actually a really great driver, and I'm really super safe. Like I'm not scared at all. I'm right. I know what I'm doing." That's not what they meant. Mm-hmm. They said, "No, it doesn't look right for people to see a woman driving by herself through mm-hmm. the countryside."
Right.
And that was the first I even thought of it. Like, it didn't dawn on me that that would be a thing that people might talk about, you know, in a gossipy kind of a way. And really, what does that mean? You know, like, yeah. I still actually don't really know what that means. But, you know, just that thought that, like, I can't do a lot of this stuff by myself because of my gender, you know. Or I can, but how much access am I going to get? Like, how are people thinking of me? And I want to believe that the more I do it and the more people get to know me, that people get to know my name, and it won't become such an issue. But the reality is that most of the musicians I met during my Fulbright, it was with Carl by my side mm-hmm. as my guide mm-hmm. for the majority.
Right. Once you collect this music and you've spent the year there and you've been there multiple times now, what happens with it? Is it written? Is the music written down? Is it categorized and put in some database by you? Because, you know, oftentimes, you know, you anthropologists, let's say, they'll go collect some field work, and then, you know, you write it down in words, and then that's how the papers are written and the books are published and all that, and future generations have the benefit of that work. But with music and dance, obviously, it's a bit different. So what happens once you gather this large body of work?
Right now, I just have my own archive that I've been building. So I get it home, I upload it, and I have my own like folders set up by date and location. And I have a lot of material that hasn't been used, right? But for the material that I need to use for research, then I go in and I make further like tags of what's in what section, so I can utilize it and go straight to it. You know, if I need to look for, you know, a certain leginyesh, if I need to, you know, look for a certain conversation that we had, that kind of a thing, then I make further tags into those recordings, and then I use those, you know, for articles, for presentations, for, you know, for research purposes. Mm-hmm. I have been, since COVID started, I've been spending a little bit more time just going through and posting it online, like on my YouTube channel, for example. And, you know, this is kind of like my way of like trying to give back a little bit, like a little bit of PR for these musicians who gave me their time, you know, always with their permission. And I've never had anybody say no. Mm-hmm. People like to have, you know, their abilities shared and they want to be talked about. So so I have been going through and just selecting these little tiny clips, anywhere from like a minute to like maybe up to 5 minutes, something like that. Like the one that you played, putting it on YouTube and trying to share it, try to get as many people to share it as possible, like on Facebook, social media and stuff like that. And I kind of have been looking around a little bit for like any kind of maybe archives, someplace where I could possibly donate some of these recordings to, because I feel like I have so many hours. But it's not clear to me what that process is right now, like, or who would be interested in housing, you know, the full archive that I have been building so far. So if you hear of anything, let me know.
Yeah, I mean, my big connection there is with the List Academy, obviously, you know, from Shoma all the way up to Pavoy, you know. So those are good people to talk to. And there's, you know, I wonder if are you know, people doing the type of work in Hungary with all their DLAs and PhD people, are you seeing people doing similar work to you? You know, your some of your other work, you know, you're looking at how the style of a violinist might reflect their identity or background or class standing. You know, you've looked at differences between institutionalized musicians, make like institutionalized, not institutionalized, but institutionally. There's some of that too, but
there should be anyway. Yeah.
Institutionally trained musicians, like conservatory trained, like Ovidiu Bartas, versus someone like Cordoba Florin, who's very much village trained. Like, what are there people? Are there people doing that type of work that you know about?
I feel like a lot of the work that my European colleagues are doing is like more along the lines of like like what I was talking about before, about like collecting and categorizing speaking you know, in terms of history and historically. I don't know how much is really being done in terms of like a social socio-anthropological kind of a bent to it. I didn't see any other researchers out in the field while I was there. It doesn't mean that they weren't there. There's a couple of people in Kolozsvár who are also ethnomusicologists and dealing with some Transylvanian aspects, but it tends to be... It tends to be like analyzing music as an object,
right?
Usually.
Yeah, so that's the European approach versus the U.S. approach, a generalization. I love what you're doing. You know, I love that human touch. And I it might take someone like you, Colleen, who's really doesn't physically reside there and doesn't necessarily speak the language on the mother level, doesn't, you know, didn't grow up in that atmosphere, or within even just listening to the music, you know, that type of 30,000 foot approach. You know, I think it's fascinating. You know, I wanted to ask you before we wrap up, what would be a successful career for you? What do you wish to accomplish with all of this?
I really want to try to find some kind of a balance between teaching and performing. So, you know, whether that's at a university somewhere, you know, as a tenured professor in the future, or if it was an outside institution, you know, that it doesn't have to be university affiliated, but if it was a folklore center of some sort, where I would be able to continue the work that I have been doing, the research that I have been doing, and writing, some kind of balance between that ethnographic writing and performing the stuff, keeping my hands in that would be amazing.
You're teaching at Augsburg. It's back to school in already or a couple of weeks online or whatever?
Yeah, we're doing a hybrid of synchronous and asynchronous instruction. Yeah.
Okay, what does that mean? Sorry. Synchronous means at the same time live?
Yeah, but online. Like, so Zoom, for example.
Okay. Okay.
Like a lecture, but on Zoom. And then asynchronous is like I'm setting up lessons for them to like go online and just like read and do quizzes on their own.
Got it. So you're teaching this semester at least a class called Worlds of Music?
Yep.
Tell me you're sneaking in some Transylvanian stuff, please.
I will definitely be sneaking some in right in the middle of the semester, yeah.
Oh, I like it. Good. Well, yeah. you know, it is it's a real pleasure to speak with you, Colleen, and I'm looking forward to having you back on and continue. There's a lot of roads we could go down and haven't gone down. We didn't even talk much about Saska and all the work for now, at least 2 decades the band's been doing with our good friends Doug and Sarah and yourself. And there's a lot of other stuff we can talk about. But you know, I guess the last question I had for you is, you know, is there anything in terms of the Tanzhaz movement, especially here in North America, what support, what help, what assistance would you need from us in terms of making your job better or easier, you know, in terms of the ethnomusicological front? Any tips or advice or help we can give you?
Oh, that's a great question. I would need to think a little bit about it, but, you know, any kind of networking support is always helpful. You know, whether it's here on the home front or, you know, when we're able to travel again, you know, making more sustained connections overseas as well. That's always great. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Great. Well, we will do that. And maybe someone sitting on a wad of cash who wants to I know this is not, you know, no one does this one for the money. That's for sure. Right. It's nice to be a professor and get tenure and do all that. And then you can, you know, spend the next year and 8 years whenever you get the 1 year sabbatical, right? So I know that's kind of how it works. But Colleen, thank you so much for your time and for your energy and for all you're doing with this music and with this thing we love and take granted so often.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the chance to talk with you, Ochi.
Thank you very much. And on behalf of myself, Kama Magyarucci, and Tanzhaz Talk Program, and Dr. Colleen Birch, ethnomusicologist, thank you all for tuning in, and see you next time. Make sure you share the show with some friends. Thank you. See you next time.